KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, the UN Human Rights Chief this week says Myanmar's brutal treatment of Rohingya Muslims appears to be a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims have crossed into Bangladesh to escape the military crackdown. We get the latest on the situation. Then at 9:30, lawmakers are calling for a probe of Equifax and stricter rules protecting consumer data after the credit reporting company revealed last week that a data breach in May exposed up to 143 million Americans' social security numbers and other personal data. We look at how hackers might use the information. That's all next on Forum. Join us. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. More than 370,000 Rohingya refugees have fled from Myanmar into neighboring Bangladesh to escape state violence against the Muslim minority group. The Myanmar military says it's responding to attacks by a militant group associated with the Rohingya. But the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayd Raad al-Hussein, accused the government this week of ethnic cleansing, citing extrajudicial killings, rape, and other brutal acts. The UN Security Council is due to meet today to discuss the crisis. We go first to South Asia editor for the BBC, Anbarasan Etharajan. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you describe the situation? We've heard about burned villages, killings, and rapes where the Rohingya live. Is that still happening?
According to people who are coming out of this Rakhine state in Myanmar, which was known as Burma earlier, this is in the western part of the country bordering Bangladesh in East Asia. They share a border of about 300 kilometers. And in the northern part of this Rakhine state, Muslim Rohingyas, they live. They have been living there for generations. And the people have been fleeing violence inside the Rakhine state. They accuse the Myanmar army and also Buddhist mob of attacking them, burning down their villages and their properties. So the number has reached nearly 400,000 in the last few weeks. They bring stories of horror. They say that they were shot at, their relatives were killed, women were raped, and their houses were burnt. And people are still coming out of this Rakhine state into Bangladesh, and the aid agencies say this is a humanitarian disaster because they don't have enough money to feed these people, and they have to provide shelter to these hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims. Bangladesh is already home to more than 400,000 Rohingya Muslims. These people escaped violence from the 80s onwards. There was a wave of violence in the 80s and also in 2012. That was the last wave of violence and last year. And I was based in Bangladesh for a few years for the BBC. At that time, I traveled across this region, the border area, when the last exodus happened. These people are viewed by the Myanmar government and by majority of the Buddhists as illegal immigrants from neighboring Bangladesh. They do not have any citizenship rights. They cannot go to school. They don't have any land deeds. They cannot marry outside their community. They are not recognized properly. But the Rohingya Muslims say, you know, they have been living there for centuries because when Myanmar was carved out of British India in 1937, the Western Rakhine became part of Myanmar, and they've been described as one of the most persecuted minorities in the world.
They're persecuted there, and I'm understanding that as they try to cross into Bangladesh, there are reports of landmines that have been set. Is that happening as well? And what is the death toll from that, if you know?
Human rights groups allege that the Myanmar army has been planting landmines in new areas along this border. You know, this is a small river separates most of the border areas. The river is called Naf River. And then if you cross the river, it's all paddy fields or jungles. And many of these areas, I've seen people like going from one end to another because, you know, they marry with each other from Rohingya community on both sides. Now, the human rights groups allege that the Myanmar army has started planting, laying landmines in these areas. And We know at least 3 people were killed in landmine blast in the last few days. This is according to hospital sources in the city of Cox's Bazar in southeastern Bangladesh, which is the nearest city to Myanmar border. And also some of the refugees, they say they were injured because of this landmine blast. This is what the accusation also from the rights groups. However, the Myanmar government says that they didn't put any new landmines along the border, and whatever is there, they were planted much earlier. But there is a suspicion among some of the Rohingya Muslim leaders that the government is trying to put new landmines, or the fear of landmines will prevent people from going back into Myanmar.
The UN Security Council is due to meet today to discuss the crisis, and it was reported that Myanmar's leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, would participate. Now we're hearing that she is no longer planning to?
According to Myanmar government officials, the state councillor and foreign minister Aung San Suu Kyi has decided to postpone her meeting in the United Nations, mainly because she wanted to focus on the issues on the current developments within the country. But many people would see this as that she is not willing to face up to the international community when she goes and meets world leaders, because the pictures of these fleeing refugees are being broadcast, being told in many media organizations throughout the world. And this is creating very strong impressions on why these people are targeted, why these people are fleeing violence in Myanmar. And most of them carry similar tales of their houses being burned down and their relatives were being shot at. Just to put the other side of the story, what the Myanmar government says is that the militants from the Rohingya community, they first initiated a wave of attacks on police checkpoints in the Rakhine state, and then the military responded to the violence. And they also accused these militants of attacking some of the Buddhist villages and Hindu villages. This is the version given by the Myanmar government. However, there is no independent verification of either of these claims. And the Myanmar government now says that the state councillor Aung San Suu Kyi, the de facto leader, will not attend this meeting, and instead somebody else will represent. Critics have been saying that she has disappointed the international community by keeping quiet or not speaking out against violence against these Rohingya people. All along, she has been maintaining that this has been going on for decades and we cannot solve it in such a short time. And also, she blamed the violence on these Muslim militants in Rakhine state. And she also considers, from her statements, if you see, that many of these Rohingya Muslims may not belong to Myanmar. And she says that we need to find out who really belongs to Myanmar.
Well, Anbarasan Etharajan, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Anbarasan Etharajan is the South Asia editor for the BBC. We're joined now by Joshua Kurlancic. He's senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good morning, Joshua Kurlancic.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here this morning. I guess one of the big questions is, what is the Myanmar government so afraid of if they defend the Rohingya Muslims, or at least denounce the actions by the military?
What are they afraid of if they defend the Rohingya?
Or at least speak out and denounce the violence. I guess, what's the concern about this community that lives in this mostly Buddhist state and nation?
Well, there's been a history of discrimination against the Rohingya and going back decades. And then since Myanmar changed from being a military-run government to a sort of quasi-civilian government, and now the Suu Kyi-led government, there's been multiple waves of violence in Rakhine State. This is just the latest. So you have a long-standing history of tension and strife. The Myanmar military, I don't think, has any interest at all in defending the rights of the Rohingya. They may believe that their insurgents are a legitimate threat to them. I don't know if that's based in reality or not, but it's certainly based in decades of Myanmar military's sort of strategy towards minorities and insurgent groups, which has been extremely brutal.
Yes, it's very clear that the military isn't interested, but there are, the seats that are essentially those that support, Aung San Suu Kyi, right? And Aung San Suu Kyi can speak out as someone who does not control the military, but why is she not doing that?
Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold. Well, there could be a number of explanations. First of all, I'm not actually sure that many or that many of the people in Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the NLD, care about what happens to the Rohingya and Rakhine State. In the run-up to the November 2015 elections when Aung San Suu Kyi was elected, at that time, she repeatedly played down the crisis, which was already simmering then, warned foreign journalists not to exaggerate the plight of the Rohingya, and tried to avoid talking about it on the campaign trail. Going back years, there hasn't really been a lot of evidence that she has an interest in this situation. So it may not make political sense in Myanmar for her to talk about it. It's not a defense of her policies, but it's probably accurate that most of the people in her party and who voted for her, this is not a priority issue for them.
Yes, but I
there
guess
there are other factors. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I guess that just goes back to my earlier question, Joshua Karlancic, is are they concerned that, you know, speaking out and denouncing the violence by the military will somehow, I mean, besides the political implications of that, you know, are they concerned that they just don't want to support a Muslim minority in their country?
I don't know what's in Aung San Suu Kyi's mind, but I think that there are several factors. One, that could be possible. Two, that it's not just Muslim, but there's all sorts of issues of citizenship and land rights, et cetera. But Suu Kyi may feel that since she has virtually no control over the military, why use whatever power she does have to speak out about this if it's not even an issue that resonates with her political base? Suu Kyi is a very stubborn person, spent decades under house arrest, and her stubbornness served her very well then. It may not serve her so well now in that the more foreigners pressure her or denounce her, it probably makes her more intransigent. And finally, she knows that probably no matter what happens in the private meeting that was called today at the UN or other UN meetings, that nothing is going to really happen to the Myanmar government. Russia and China sit on the Security Council, and I doubt that any real formal action will be taken. And then finally, you know, I think that if the image of Aung San Suu Kyi was formed one way while she was under house arrest, it was sort of formed in part by filling in a political vacuum because we didn't really know much about her. So now that vacuum is her biography and how she acts as a politician is somewhat being filled in, and it's not always consistent with the image that existed before.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join the conversation. We're talking about the military crackdown of a Muslim minority group in the predominantly Buddhist nation of Myanmar. The UN human rights chief this week says Myanmar's brutal treatment of the Rohingya Muslims appears to be a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. What are your thoughts or questions for Joshua Karlancic? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook. You can tweet us at KQED Forum or email us at forum@kqed.org. A listener writes, the UN Commission on Human Rights is quite correct. This is a mass genocide and ethnic cleansing against helpless, innocent Muslim civilians, sponsored, led, and approved by the Myanmar government, led by their military junta, and sanctioned by Myanmar's national leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who should be stripped of her Nobel Peace Prize. Joshua Karlancic, what can the UN do, and what do you think they're preparing to do with this meeting?
It's not a military junta anymore, although the military does have basically total control over the three ministries that are related to security and their budget. So they certainly have an enormous amount of power. The UN they can make a statement calling for the Myanmar government to allow aid workers access to all the parts of Rakhine State, where right now they're getting limited access. That would probably be helpful. They could call for UN monitors to have access to all over Rakhine State, which they haven't been getting, which would be helpful in trying to sort out information from misinformation. I support, and I don't know if this would be through a UN venue, but the UN could call for an aid conference or some sort of aid mechanism to to help fund the camps in Bangladesh, which are overcrowded and in not good shape, and are not providing, being able to provide people with the quality of life that they need, and are in desperate need of funds. Beyond that, probably not very much. I don't think the UN is going to do much beyond that.
Well, we've got calls coming in. Let's go to Amina in Berkeley. Hi, Amina.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just want to say, as an American Muslim who is constantly having to condemn terrorism, whether it's by ISIS, whether it's by Al-Qaeda, the fact that a Nobel Peace Prize winner is watching the exodus of 400,000 people, the killing of 5,000 people, the rape, the burning of houses, you know, clear genocide, and is allowed to not condemn this because it doesn't suit her interests, is just mind-boggling. Where are the peaceful Buddhists? We know there are Buddhist monks who are behind this. Why are they getting let off so easily? And why is the UN, which was created to end genocide, always faced with we can't do anything because of China, Russia, or somebody else?
Well, Amina, you raise some really powerful points, and she also uses the word genocide. Siddhartha, one listener asks, when does ethnic cleansing turn into genocide in the press, media, and diplomatic world? Is ethnic cleansing too light a term for this, Joshua Kurlansik?
I'm not an expert on the definition of genocide. I don't know. There is an actual genocide definition that has been put forth. Just to go back to the first listener, I don't think Suu Kyi's being let off the hook by the international community. And if you're just talking about leaders and activists and the press, I mean, the press coverage of Suu Kyi is scathing, right? And other Nobel Prize winners are telling her that she should have her prize stripped. And so the question isn't really what outside observers who maybe previously had admired Suu Kyi think, but whether anyone can actually do anything, that is what I'm addressing here. The basic fundamental fact of the UN Security Council is there's five permanent members, and two of them are Russia and China. Suu Kyi's security advisor has said that they will rely on Russia and China to block any resolution. I should also add, and that doesn't mean that it shouldn't try, I should also add in that there's a further factor here in which the U.S. government, which until the Obama administration had sanctions on Myanmar, but then still tried to do certain things to promote human rights in Myanmar, is kind of in a difficult situation in which basically the president and the secretary of state have stated that promoting rights and democracy isn't really to them a core value of U.S. foreign policy anymore. So that has an overall global effect as well as in Myanmar.
So then make that connection. How does it play into specifically the situation in Myanmar? What you're describing is essentially the U.S.'s, you know, diminished role, I guess, in terms of promoting democracy.
Well, I mean, it comes back anywhere. But if Ambassador Haley, who actually is, I think, a pretty strong supporter of rights in Burma, was to be involved in a resolution. Again, this meeting at the UN was called by Britain and Sweden, but Suu Kyi could and other Myanmar people could say, well, why are you picking on us? You know, I mean, your policy is you don't really care. You invited the dictator of Egypt, who has, I don't know, tens of thousands of political prisoners, to the White House. You offered an invitation to Rodrigo Duterte, who has overseen a drug war in the Philippines, has killed thousands of people extrajudicially. Yes. So there's a comeback in that way, but also it sets a tone for U.S. policy that just makes it hard to decide that now you're going to care about rights and democracy.
We're talking with Joshua Kurlansik, Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia for the Council on Foreign Relations. And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Phil in Oakland. Hi, Phil.
Thanks for a really interesting discussion. And I have two questions. One, is there any talk of reviewing these arbitrary colonial borders and just saying, you know, Myanmar just saying, okay, this state is now part of Bangladesh. It's your problem. We don't want to deal with it anymore. And why don't they just do that? Is there some important resource there? And then among this militant movement, is there any connection to internationally funded jihadi movements that we see cropping up all over the world? I mean, it seems like the press has decided that this is just an attack by the Myanmar government, but it's everywhere around the world there are these kind of jihadi movements causing lots of problems. And is this connected or not?
Phil, thanks. Joshua Kurlancic.
Yeah, I don't know if the press has ignored it, but there is some potential link. The International Crisis Group, which is a group that is sort of like an analysis group, has done several reports on by looking at some of the members of this kind of somewhat shadowy group that's attacked police posts and army bases in Myanmar, trying to figure out whether they had links with Rohingya exiles in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, and whether they were getting funds or were linked to groups in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Definitely, reporters are actively following that story, and I think the issue is less that they're trying to play it down and more that so far there hasn't been a lot of information gleaned because it's very new, but it's definitely a possibility that the Rohingya insurgent groups do have links to some other either militant groups or just to Rohingya exiles who want to fund or radicalize Rohingya and are based out of the country. Beyond that, I don't know more because it just hasn't had a lot come out more about it.
Well, we have just a minute left on this segment, so okay. I don't know if you wanted to briefly answer the
I was just
going to
say
Phil's
the Myanmar government and Bangladesh aren't going to change the border because really neither of them really wants the Rohingya, so Bangladesh is not going to take them all in either.
Well, a listener asks, how's the government in Bangladesh reacted to the refugee crisis?
I mean, in some ways, they've done their best. I mean, Bangladesh is a relatively poor developing country now, has massive refugee camps on their eastern border. But they don't want the camps aren't in great shape, and they haven't done a great job accommodating more Rohingya. They certainly don't want Rohingya staying in the country and becoming real residents. So, mixed, I would say, mixed.
And with, again, just seconds left, I'm curious about two things. One is, what is the end game for the Rohingya militants, right, who attacked the police post back in August? And also, do you see, the military reaching some kind of conclusion in terms of their campaign?
Well, the military calls it like a clearance operation, which means that they're going to probably try to, if they're not stopped in some way, destroy more villages and cut any insurgent groups off from food, fuel, and other types of support, and circle villages with military troops. That's a traditional strategy they've done, and destroy some villages as well. So something grim. The insurgents haven't been that clear. I mean, I guess possibly they would want their own state, but it may be that they simply want to exact vengeance. They haven't developed into one coherent group that has enunciated clear demands over and over and is clearly understood.
Well, Joshua Kurlancic, thanks very much for talking with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Joshua Kurlancic, Senior Fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Another half hour Forum next on Equifax. Stay with us.